The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
It's
the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to seven continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Tuesday evening Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. Great to have you on board. We have one of our favorite authors with us tonight, and he has a really, I wish I could do like Ed Sullivan did, but a really good, maybe Rod knows how to do that. Maybe
a
most
really
of,
big shoe.
Yeah, maybe most of you don't even know who Ed Sullivan was because you were born many, many decades after him. But Space 2.0, but more about that in just a minute. Let me run through our typical announcements. But we're doing the 60-minute show tonight because Rod is in the Midwest getting ready to open his presidential campaign in Iowa. So he's got a big meeting tomorrow with the press, and we're going to allow him off easy tonight. But you can call us, and if you want to talk to Rod, 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com, and, of course, the blog for the Space Show, which is on our website. If you need information on that, email me, and I'll be glad to send you a quick set of instructions for how to do that. Remember to check out our website newsletter. It is current on the website, upper right. And when you open it up to see all the programming this week, then you will also see the schedule of what we have for the rest of first quarter 2019, and we're starting to fill out second quarter 2019. All of those programs are listed. There is a store for Space Show logo wear, and the best way to access it, the quickest way, is on the right side of every Space Show page. You will see Pepper swag for the Space Show. Just click on Pepper's really beautiful face, and that will open you up to our Cafe Press store. Pepper swag is at the bottom of that page, but we have all sorts of Space Show items there for you to check out as well. And recommendations are always welcome, comments are always welcome, and of course purchases are always welcome. And then also in the upper left menu is Listen Live, so don't forget, this tells you how to listen to live Space Show programs, compressed archive MP3s on our website, and podcasts, including those using Alexa. And if you have any questions about podcasts or archives, or you need to share this information with anyone, please contact me at our email address and feel free to share the information. Then finally, do remember, and this is very, very important, that the Space Show is a listener-supported program, and we do need your financial support to bring you great guests like Rod Pyle and others that you've been hearing of late. And we appreciate your support. Now, remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you get a tax deduction for your donation, as we are a nonprofit 501c3 on the federal side. You also get a deduction if you're a California taxpayer, as we are a public benefit corporation in California. Our parent is OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Check it out, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And if you're also interested in being on our advisory board, email me. You can also read about it on OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. Over on the left, you'll see a menu and click on Team, and then the drop-down will come down, and you'll see Advisory Board. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me. And then one more quick thing in addition to the individual support. Remember, we do have sponsors. The sponsors do get to have a banner ad going across our homepage, and they can change the banner as often as they like. And then on longer shows, 90-minute shows, I read brief sponsor messages. But on the programs like tonight that are the 60-minute version, I just mention our sponsors and thank them very, very much, because without their great support, we would not be doing Space Show programs. So I do want to thank Northrop Grumman, the Space Foundation, Moonwords, AIAA, Space Development Organization, Celestis, the National Space Society, and the Space Plan, the Integrated Space Plan. If you have any questions about the sponsors or you have any information you need, please don't hesitate to contact me, and I'll be happy to put you in touch with these terrific sponsors, and we're deeply appreciative of them for sponsoring the space show. As I said, our guest is Rod Pyle, and he is a frequent author and visitor to the space show. He is a space author, journalist, and historian. He has written 13 books on space history, exploration, and development for major publishers that have been published in 7 languages. He is a senior editor of Ad Astra magazine, the quarterly print publication of the National Space Society, and his articles have frequently appeared in Space.com, Live Science, Futurity, Huffington Post, and Wired. Rod has written extensively for NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab and Caltech. He has authored the Apollo Executive Leadership Program for JSC, the Conference Board. His most recent book release is Amazing Stories of the Space Age. That was a 2017 book. And he is currently under option for television. Great going, Rod. He writes a technical publication called Technology Highlights for NASA and JPL. And he is frequently on national radio and TV shows with regular slots on KFI Los Angeles, WGN Chicago. He has recently been featured on PBS's Between the Lines, C-SPAN's Book TV. He holds an MA from Stanford and a BFA from the Art Center College of Design. He lives in Southern California, and he's also been on the space show on and off for many, many years. He goes way back, and he will be on the space show again soon, because he has another terrific book coming out, which we'll talk about in detail later, about going to the moon and in celebration of Apollo's big anniversary coming up. But tonight we're talking to Rod about Space 2.0, how private spaceflight, a resurgent NASA, and international partners are creating a new space age. And our great friend Buzz Aldrin wrote a foreword for the book. Rod, welcome back. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me back. I'm cold.
Well,
I left California on last Wednesday, where it was, you know, Southern California, it's about 58, 65 degrees. Went to Tucson for the Tucson Festival of Books, which was great. And 130,000 people there in 75 to 80 degree heat. And now I'm in Des Moines, Iowa for another conference where I'll have a panel of Apollo astronauts tomorrow, which is cool. And it's 5 degrees outside.
Well, no one told you to run for president and go knock on doors in Iowa, so what? No sympathy for me.
Hey, I may be dumb, but I ain't dumb enough to get to politics, my friend.
what is in Iowa? What brings you up there?
There's a conference, a gentleman named Tony Poston, who I met at Space Fest, but he's also part of the National Space Society now because I dragged him in to help us out. And he puts on a conference called Celebrate Innovation Week, or CI Week, every year, this time of year. Normally it's not this cold, and there isn't 3 feet of snow on the ground, by the way. This is a weird winter here. And it's this wonderful 3-day event that he does where he brings in, it's not a space conference, it's an innovation conference, where he brings in, you know, the head animator or director from Pixar. There's a Facebook executive here this year. There's a number of people from the Apollo program, of course, which is why I'm here to chat with those guys, rock and roll musicians, oceanographers, paleontologists, you name it, scientists, captains of industry. And it's just a really nice, smaller conference, about 2,000 people, 3,000 people show up. The great thing is it's free, because he goes out and gets funding for it, because you can do that in places like Des Moines. And so everybody's able to come and get inspired and listen to these great speakers for nothing.
Well, and all of this, you wrote a book about Space 2.0, which is about the new space industry. So first of all, what is this on the cover? It looks kind of like I'm looking at a scene from War of the Worlds or something.
Well, that was tricky. You know, I went through a lot of iterations of ideas about the cover, and I've been working with space artist Jim Bond, who does a lot of work for the Ad Astra covers for National Space Society magazine. And, you know, I thought of everything from the Falcon Heavy, which at the point I started reading the book was still a bit off in our imagination. It was about 2014 when I got cracking on this, to something way out, you know, in the outer solar system with human spaceflight. And I thought, you know, I want something sort of in between that's inspirational, not terribly specific, because, of course, if you have a particular company's lander or nation's lander on a particular place, then somebody is going to, of course, call you up on late night radio show if I'm doing WGN overnight in Chicago and say, we ain't ever going to land there or something like that. So I thought, let's pick something that's representative and inspirational. So that's really what it does. So you can look at certain technical aspects of it. You know, you can say, well, gosh, they're a little close together, or I don't think they'd do the front of the cockpit like that or something. But the request to Jim was do something inspirational and cool and interesting. And I have to tell you, of the feedback I get from the general inspired, motivated reader, probably more of them tell me they love the cover than tell me they love the content. Now, I assume that's because they just got the book. Hopefully they'll love both, but it's got a lot of good feedback.
Tell us about the book. So how did you, what is the focus of Space 2.0? You know, all the magazine articles say Space 2, or learn about new space.
Yeah.
So what do you mean by Space 2.0?
So this started out with a combination of a couple of other book proposals I've been sort of kicking around, and I kind of mushed them together, and then I sent that out. Really what I wanted to do was write about the new space age, because this was a few years after the end of the shuttle program, and we were kind of in what I think some of us felt were spaceflight doldrums. The space station was still up on the human side, I mean. Planetary goes on unfettered. But on the human spaceflight side, space station's up there doing great work, runs overhead every 90 minutes. Some people understand what it's doing and what it's about, some don't, so we need to push that a bit to the public. But really, we weren't launching our own people and our own machinery, and that was kind of a tough bone to swallow for a lot of folks. So I thought, well, okay, we're a few years out from hopefully these private-public partnerships taking place. And so I wanted to write about that, and then it broadened to kind of becoming what I think you could consider a handbook, or at least an introduction to this new space age, the cusp of this new space age that we're on right now, looking at, it looks at a lot of things, but one broad topic we revisit quite a bit is, you know, where are the smart places or the overlaps of NASA, international space agencies, the new space commercial sector in the U.S., the traditional aerospace contractors, and finally some of the smaller international players that are beginning to do private things, like we've seen with SpaceIL and the reusable booster companies that are springing up in China. You know, where is the point at which, or the set of points at which, these things can really work optimally together to push this ahead faster? Because, you know, we're getting dangerously close to being almost as far from the Apollo 11 landing as it was from the first flight of the Wright brothers. And you really can't compare those two 50, 60-year stretches in terms of productivity. So that's kind of what the story's about.
What do you think those merger points are?
Boy, start right out with the softball, huh?
Yeah, well.
Yeah. I think we're seeing it to some extent with the agreements between NASA and SpaceX, a smaller set of agreements with Blue Origin. We've long had NASA hiring the traditional aerospace companies like Northrop Grumman and Boeing and Lockheed and so forth. But because largely, I think, of what's been going on with SpaceX especially, there's been pressure for those traditional aerospace contractors to change how they do business, and that's starting to happen. So, I mean, ideally, and this, you know, I interviewed a lot of people for this book, including you. Thank you for participating. But, you know, Lori Garber sort of laid out the groundwork of where she saw this, I think, ideal confluence of these forces. And I know that it's been discussed on your show before. I think we have, too, where, you know, NASA does what it does best, which arguably is science and exploration and pushing frontiers and going beyond Earth orbit and incentivizing these programs and, in some cases, designing them, but not probably building large hardware. They might still build robotic probes, but not the kind of things they're doing with SLS and Orion. And letting private industry do what they do best, which is now building launch vehicles and finally spacecraft. We're seeing the Crew Dragon and the not Star Chaser, the
CST-100.
CST-100. I was trying to think of the other name for it. Starliner. Come online, and hopefully soon the latest iteration of the BFR, which I think is called Starship now. Let them do what they do best, and then of course, you know, this is just the big sexy, you know, the George Clooney's of the space business, so these big rocket boosters. Private industry also comes in behind this with tons of other things, like CubeSats that can start doing tons of orbital imaging, like is already happening with Planet Labs. And Musk and the other competitors that want to bring in broadband from these very low orbit, kind of disposable small satellites that will be providing broadband all over the world. And as one of the people I interviewed for the book, Steve Jurvetson, was talking about, it was a wonderful interview. I mean, everybody was great, but he was particularly exciting because the guy's just, like, scary brilliant. He was the billionaire that raised money to invest in SpaceX in their darkest hours. And he said, you know, imagine, among other things, when you've got the whole planet wired, you know, how many more Einsteins are out there? How many more people that could become Einsteins? He was just using that as a generic, but really brilliant contributors to this global conversation in science and engineering. How many people that just lack education or just lack bandwidth are there that can really contribute to this? And it's idealistic thinking, but I think he's got something there, and I found that really particularly exciting.
Did he give you a number of how many potential Einsteins were out there, kind of like they do with extraterrestrials with the Drake equation?
No, but I bet you he could. You know, he got through Stanford Engineering undergraduate in 2.5 years and did it by, I guess the right word would be, gaming the enrollment computer. And I went there, and I could barely understand how to use the enrollment computer. He went in and somehow managed to rig things so that he could take, I think, 22 units a semester. So,
no impacted classes for him, right?
No, he just ran right through it. And the good thing is you also save money if you do that, because it's not cheap to go there.
No, that's for sure. But at least those are useful classes. And you probably can have work after you graduated in engineering from or tech something from Stanford. So good for that. You know, Fox News wrote an article today. I don't know if anyone has sent it to you or you saw it. And they said they're starting to expect a economic shakeout and fallout in the new commercial, new space, entrepreneurial business. They're looking for a lot of failures to start to happen.
Well, it's interesting you mention that. And I didn't see that article because I've been at this conference all day and networking with people that I've been waiting to meet for 30 years. So I wasn't on my computer much, but that certainly was part of the conversation, and particularly when I was talking to Chad Anderson from Space Angels, which is an investment firm on the slightly smaller side than what Jurvetson was doing. And he's saying, you know, there's room for only so many launch systems. There'll be a few really large ones like Blue Origin, SpaceX, and SLS, although that's in a whole different class. And then there's a ton of small ones, for everything from microsats up to, you know, say 5 to 10,000 pounds, but there aren't quite as many payloads as apparently coming down the pike as people thought at one time a few years ago there might be. So we saw, as you do in these things, it's a little bit like when I was working in the B movie industry decades ago, and you see these projections of we're going to make our movie for $500,000 and it'll net $30 trillion in revenue worldwide, and you go, yeah, right. And, of course, they never did. And I think there was some of that in the new space community, I mean, since the 80s, honestly, with people overstating potential earnings and rounding numbers up and using highly biased statistics and calculations to get where they wanted to go. So, yeah, I think we're going to see a shakeout in terms of launchers and probably a lot of the ground infrastructure that's starting to come around. Isn't that how it's supposed to work in capitalism, right?
Yeah, for people who might be interested, the actual title of the article, and it was on Apple News, but it's Fox Business and its billions flow to U.S. space industry, but reckoning looms. And it's by Joe Williams with a date today. He says the space industry is valued at $18 billion, and I don't know where he comes up with that number, but I think that is not even close to reality.
That number is supposedly, it's funny, I just typed that out earlier, it's what's been invested since 2009, so that's kind of a weird one to pick for total valuation. the valuation of the space market that I have more recently seen, if you include everything from boosters to chips to satellites to, you know, what you can charge for bandwidth up and down and all that, is $350 billion. And somewhere between $3 and $4 billion was put in for the private sector.
Yeah, that's what I have. I mean, SpaceX is valued at $21.5 million last year. If you
billion, if you want to
accept that.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
How do you put a value on Blue Origin? So all they've done so far is test fly, and then you've got the guy who runs it cashiering $1 billion with a B dollars of his own stock each year, which poor fella can only do it for another 150 years or so, at least before the divorce. But, you know, how do you put a valuation on that when they haven't flown anything? It's a little bit like, haven't flown commercially, I mean, it's a little bit like the way they value Facebook or Instagram, which are companies that up until recently haven't turned any profit at all.
No, but they do have revenue, and so
yeah,
they would probably, well, first of all, Blue would be really hard to value because it's so private and confidential. You don't
right.
know. But they'd probably try to get a hold of asset value for everything from real estate to all of its hardware, and that, you know, they'd probably look at replacement value of his space infrastructure.
But that's kind of how you put a value on it for replacement cost. I'm talking about when you have something like Facebook, which has been for years, you know, the value of that is blown completely out of this.
Yeah, well, so Facebook is a publicly traded company, so it's a little bit easier, but but their values are speculative, and they value management, and they have their formulas for, you know, how you're going to do that. So, you know, I'd value management at Blue Origin pretty high because of Jeff and his track record.
Yeah.
And despite the shenanigans that Musk goes through and all the reports of labor unrest and stuff at SpaceX, I'd value his management and his teams at very, very high value, too. Because he does accomplish, and if you saw the Crew Dragon launch the other night in the docking, perfect timing all the way through. I mean, incredible.
It was beautiful, and he launched right on time, didn't he?
Yeah, to the second. It wasn't even a hold. So,
and I kind of expected it for that one. I didn't expect it for the Falcon Heavy, and when that launched right on the money on the same day, I mean, you and I have both seen rocket launches. I don't know how long you waited. I waited at one point with my kid for, I think, 12 days for a shuttle. Finally saw an Atlas go up, and shuttles are human-rated spacecraft, obviously, but so is Crew Dragon. It just didn't have a person.
But you know, if SpaceX or Blue ever did an IPO and you got a hold of the prospectus, you would see how they're valuing it. You may disagree with it. You may think it's Looney Tunes, or you may think it's undervalued, but at least they would lay it out legally and in according to accounting provisions and rules, and they'd give you the assumptions that they're using, and then you could run it through your own BS detector, and if you wanted to grab a piece of the IPO and you had access to do that, maybe you'd want to, maybe you wouldn't. But
yeah, I must say, though, it's pleasing to be able to have this conversation after, despite the best efforts of some and not the best efforts of some others, what we saw in the 80s and part of the 90s, because there was a lot of stuff going on then that just didn't pass muster.
Oh, but yeah, and when I was doing my dissertation, which I finished in, I believe it was 2001, maybe early 2002, I don't remember, but none of this was even in anybody's consciousness. So Musk had not arrived on the scene. There were some people, like at Space Access Conference, talking about, you know, propulsion and rockets. We need to sell the ride to the government, but there wasn't any traction for it. And commercial companies were the traditional aerospace companies with cost-plus contracting. And I remember when I wrote my dissertation and talked about space tourism and stuff, the giggle factor was, strong and prevalent, and that doesn't exist anymore. Yeah, well, that's almost 20 years ago. So the world has changed, and I would contend, and I know you have a lot of this to some point in the book, that it probably would not have changed as dramatically or as quickly were it not for SpaceX.
I agree, and I got a little bit of pushback on that from
I'm sure you did, and I get it too, but I really believe he's the trigger catalyst, and SpaceX the trigger catalyst for the transformation that has happened.
I completely agree, and you could sit and debate, well, he got this much from the government for this and this much for that, but
who cares?
Falcon Heavy,
look what he did with it. Look what Boeing and Lockheed and
exactly.
ULA have gotten from the government and ATK and all of them.
Right.
And what did they do with it to transform the industry versus what SpaceX did with it to transform the industry?
Right, and build our future. So when I see a Delta IV Heavy go up, but I think last count it was what, 400, 450 million?
Yeah.
Does it have to be that expensive? Well, it's an older architecture, and they're obviously hard to get off the ground because it took months for the last one. So there's stuff there, but I'm with you. You know, I think it's really been an amazing time, and however you chat with people about what they want to take away from SpaceX, you gotta say, here's a guy who had a dream, he made it happen, he blew a lot of his own money on it, he invested a lot of his own money on it, came close to failure. I mean, it's the great American story of this persistent capitalist drive that makes something happen, and it's forced the other companies to respond.
Absolutely.
Might they have eventually moved that direction? We'll never know.
We'll never know, but he did move in that direction, and I think it's been good, although I do know a lot of people don't like SpaceX and this and that and the other, but I think you can't discount what they've done for the industry and their success. You have a caller. You want to take your caller?
Sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you? Where are you? And thank you very much for calling.
This is Marshall in Little Old Renfro.
Okay. Go for it, Okie.
Hey, I enjoyed this line of conversation about the valuation of our space resources. It's rather important, and you guys are really the first ones to talk about it in a logical manner. But about a year ago, I think I made a reference that Elon Musk was almost a reincarnation of Howard Hughes. And as crazy as Howard Hughes was and so on like that, you kind of go, well, he died, 30, 40 years ago?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The real question is, what's Howard Hughes' corporation or legacy worth today?
Well, it's broken up into a million different things. I don't know how you could go back and do that.
Well, Hughes Tools still exists.
Oh, yeah, but he had TWA, so you'd have to trace what TWA,
Yeah,
you've got the Howard Hughes Medical Hospital and Research Institute around Palm Springs. I don't know exactly what the actual city is.
Yeah, but I think what's really relevant here, we might recontextualize this for a second, is
go ahead,
how did
Ron.
Hughes affect humanity? I mean, look at some of the things he brought online that really changed how we live and do business, especially in terms of aviation.
Absolutely, and medical research, because the Howard Hughes Institute is really at the forefront of a lot of things because it doesn't take government money the same way everybody else does. So this is another example of a lot of places get government money, and what do they do with it? And Howard Hughes set up a system that was going to do something different. And what happened with what he did, which has just been a medical giant in the research and disease and thing fighting, far different than what the traditional models do.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe there are some comparisons between Howard Hughes and, I mean, they both went after starlets and beautiful women. I'll give them that credit.
Yes.
Well, hey, I got a question for our caller.
What if
Howard Hughes had Twitter? That's a scary thought.
Howard Hughes had Hollywood almost as bad.
That's true. Yeah, you got
but
Jane Russell was one of his discoveries, wasn't she?
Well, I don't remember, but you can see them all on different TWA airplanes with him and all of that.
Yeah.
And of course, he had the Spruce Goose, which was his albatross. But what the hell? He was a colorful character. I mean, you know, and when he had the penthouse at, what was it, the Desert Inn in Las Vegas,
mm-hmm.
And owned the Strip for the most part. I mean, a real part of American history. But, yeah, and Hughes Tool was instrumental in getting us satellites, geosynchronous satellites, came out of Howard Hughes. you know, the early days of the space industry, going to the moon, a lot of components. So, Marshall, let's see, we'd have to look at how many years Howard Hughes has been dead before Musk got born and see if there was any reincarnation link there.
Okay, I won't touch
Wait,
that.
Wait, am I on Coast to Coast here or something? Did we just change shows?
One thing I would like to add, though.
Yeah.
In Howard Hughes' lifetime, nobody had a real clue at what was going to be valuable 20 and 30 years on. And we're kind of stuck in the same place. We got to go out and try a lot of crazy stuff, but some of it turns out to be unbelievably worthwhile. Well, some of it, you know, kind of putzes along and eventually dies, and, you know, people can say it didn't really work too well. But, hey, you got to go out and try.
Well, you got to inspire risk-taking, and risk-taking inspires innovation. You know, they run together, and that's absolutely key in your economic system. So,
And I think this is part of what we're seeing. We haven't talked about it yet, but when you look at Bezos, who, as far as I know, is still, I know he's still pushing Blue Moon. Things do change over time. That's his commercial lunar lander. But what really got me interested in that was not just the fact that it would take cargo to the moon, but the fact that he was specifically designing to bring cargo back. I thought, well, that's vision and a certain amount of leap of faith, because we're not absolutely positive there's anything we want to bring back yet except people and possibly some hardware. So, you know, to me, that shows a lot of inspiration, a lot of belief. And again, this is a guy that's putting a billion of his own money in every year. That's really putting your money where your mouth is.
One final note. Manufacturing on the moon, making products for Earth. That actually has a lot of future possibility, even though we have no clue what the product's going to be.
Yeah, I'd like to see him do a little more manufacturing and making products for use in space first, because, you know, we still have this huge roadblock of, even though it's gotten much cheaper, largely thanks to SpaceX and some of the other companies coming online, we still got this huge cost of delivery. And when it costs thousands of dollars to launch a single gallon of water, I mean, that's why astronauts recycle water on the space station, because it costs so much. And fuel and so forth. Wouldn't it be great to be able to get it up there? And I know Dave and I have talked about this on the show. I'm sure you talk about it all the time. But we got a lot of resources out there. Even if you can just corral some of the junk that's in orbit, all these spent rocket stages and bits of detritus up there, and refabricate them into things that are useful. I mean, we've spent a lot of time and effort and money and sweat launching metallic mass into low Earth orbit. Let's use it. Let's get up there and reprocess this stuff, and we can practically build a small planet out of it at this point, I would imagine.
And we kill two birds with one stone.
Yep.
Where would we be? Where do you think we'll be from what you talk about in your book 20 years from now? Will your book be currently out of date, or will it be still something that people will want to research and reference and use?
Well, my plan is that by that time they're researching and referencing and using the 20th edition of Space 2.0, because I would love to update the thing every year. I have to tell you, I mean, I usually write histories, as you know, and that's pretty easy because the past doesn't change too much. Sometimes something new comes along, and the last, you know, the 11th hour, I got to fix something in the book. But this one was, it was a killer because it's this constantly moving target, and because it was a long march in the book, I think I talked to you in late 2015, early 2016, David.
I thought it was 2017, but maybe I'm...
It might have been 2017, but I started working on it in 2015, and it wasn't done until, I don't know, 6 months ago, 5 months ago. And so I'd have to keep coming back and combing through, and you know how it is when you did this with your dissertation, about the 40th time you're reading your own writing, you just want to have a medical emergency so you can get away from it for a while. And, you know, I had to keep calling the publisher and saying, I'm really sorry, but Elon changed the name of the BFR again. It's now Starship and so forth. So, yeah, it's a real moving target. So I suspect, you know, I'll be happy if it's 30 or 40%, right? But if I may, a quick story about this. At the ISDC in 2018 in L.A., we had Freeman Dyson as one of our speakers. And, you know, famous guy, noted futurist and so forth. he had this talk about how we're going to populate the solar system that involved semi-cyborg breeding stations on space colonies or generational ships. It evolved telepresent parents, probably Chinese. I never did figure out why he thought they would be, that would raise the children via remote links and all this kind of stuff. Two very interesting things happened. One is he polarized the audience because a lot of people got kind of cranky at some of his ideas. But that's and I was watching him do this, and he was kind of he was I think feeding on that a little bit, because what's the mission of a futurist? You project the future at 700%. You hope that people understand half of that, and then you hope that they come on board with a smaller percentage, and then you hope that maybe 30 or 40 or 60% of that happens. So he did exactly what he was supposed to do, which is get people to notice and think and get their heads wrapped around this and hopefully participate. And I'm no Freeman Dyson. You know, I'm a molecule in his left fingernail, but intellectually, but at least if it gets people thinking and talking about this. And as you've seen, if you've read any of it, it's really, you know, it's designed for a very general audience. It's not designed for people who are already working in the trade. It's not designed for people who've been studying this for 10 or 15 years. It's designed for regular folks that are curious about what might be coming and how they can get involved in a part of it.
Marshall, what else, in case someone else wants to give us a call?
Yeah, I've had more fun than I should, and keep it up.
Thank you, Marshall.
Thank you, Marshall.
Marshall, ladies and gentlemen, has vacated our phone number, and if you want to call us, it is 1-866-687-7223. There's still time for your call. You can also use email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. Your book has a lot in there about international cooperation. And
That was a tough one.
Well, so I was going to ask you to talk about that, because, you know, I do a lot of programs with people, and probably 50% of the people don't like the fact that we're purposely seeking international space cooperation, because they say it delays the projects and raises the cost, and we don't need it. Others say we do need it, if for no other reason. We don't have enough money ourselves anymore. We need their buckaroos. So talk to us about international.
I think that philosophically we should. I think it's the best way for human beings to progress is to pull together and do so in gung-ho fashion. How realistic is that? I don't know. You know, I still, to this day, have not yet found a reliable study of the space station, the International Space Station, that I would completely trust about who paid for what and how that worked out. You find it kind of all over the map. I think you've probably seen the same thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, it looks roughly 50-50 if you combine everybody else plus us, but that doesn't include, then you look and you say, well, gee, that doesn't include the cost of all the shuttle launches at $1 billion to $1.5 billion a crack. So it's a really hard thing to say. I would love to see, again, the best of everything come together. One thing I would cite in that conversation is, I was talking to someone at JPL recently who's fairly high up in management, who was talking about, we were talking about missions to Mars, just as an example. If JPL does a Mars lander, it's, let's say an orbiter, it's probably, I don't know at this point, $400 to $600 million, if you include launch costs and so forth. And we need them, you know. We there's a lot of things we want to do at Mars. The Indian government did the Mars orbiting mission for $36 million. Now, does that include all the real costs of the launch? Probably not. Does that include some other supplementary costs? Possibly not. And it was a less ambitious mission in some ways than what we're doing now, because they were just starting out. But their first one worked. So JPL is involved, and NASA is involved in a conversation with them about a mission that would be largely designed and programmatically put together by the U.S., built over there, which, by the way, at least according to this person, their workforce in that sector is up to 80% women, because they're just as well trained but less expensive than male workers, which I found interesting, and have it built and then flown cooperatively, but the controlled command and control comes out of Jet Propulsion Laboratory and NASA and probably some universities. Well, that's, to me, that's good bang for your buck in terms of internationalism. On the other hand, when you see the kind of intellectual property shenanigans that go on with some countries, in particular China. It's not a matter of us giving it to them because we're cooperating. It's a matter of things just get snatched out of the bag. And as we were talking about before we went on the air, recently we saw a couple of test launches of small reusable boosters from China that look a whole lot like the Falcon 9. And when pressed on the subject, one of the people they interviewed said, well, yeah, you know, why would we start from scratch when we've got that perfect example? And I don't like that logic. It's hard to argue with it, but it really goes against the grain, I think, of Western society, who says, well, you should go design your own, and you should go through the same painful process as us. But we could make the same argument about any of these new companies, to an extent, who have benefited so greatly from what the U.S. and the Soviet Union did during the space race in the 1960s, when we did a lot of that heavy lifting that everybody builds on now. So it's a difficult conversation.
That it is. But so you think it's worth the cost overruns and the delays to do international space projects?
You're a harsh man.
Well, I mean, that's,
no, I know what you're saying.
That's really how it gets framed. So,
yeah, I think in a perfect world, I'd like to see intelligent choices made. So, for instance, in the 60s, when we wanted to cooperate with the Soviet Union, Kennedy put out feelers. Then the Soviets put out feelers early on about cooperating on the moon mission. Kennedy was assassinated. That conversation went away and, as far as I know, never came back. So we didn't have any real cooperation until the Apollo-Soyuz test flight. However, where we did have cooperation was on the robotic exploration side, where there was this kind of low-level back-channel communication and sharing of data going back and forth. And that sort of set the stage in many ways for what later happened on the human side. So that was an intelligent set of choices, kind of low risk. You know, they were flinging robotic explorers out like softballs in the 60s, and some of them worked and some of them didn't. We had a slightly more steady pace at a lower launch rate, but we were benefiting a little bit from the things we learned from each other, sometimes on purpose, sometimes not. And so I think there's an intelligent way to do that, and I think what I just laid out about the cooperative Mars mission is one way. In terms of on the commercial side, that gets trickier. You know, if we have commercial launch providers in the U.S., but an Asian competitor comes along and says, I got something that looks a whole lot like the Falcon Heavy, and I'll give it to you for half, we've already seen what happens. We've seen it in cars. We've seen it in manufacturing of electronics. You know, first Japan was the big threat to us in the 80s, and then the next thing you know, Japan was handed their lunch by China, who Japan had been hiring to manufacture things that were designed and sold under Japanese labels, and then the Chinese said, Bill, we can do that without you, and they did. So what happens next? So I'm hearing around your question, actually.
I have an email question from you from Todd, our listener in San Diego.
Okay.
And he said, over the years, at least since SpaceX has been on the scene, there have been various reports of pockets of resistance to new space and the evolving new commercial space industry in Congress, with groups that still have loyalty to traditional aerospace companies, traditional ways of doing things, not trusting the new companies for human flight safety or for safety even for government large national security payloads. How do you see Congress and the emerging commercial space industries now? Is there still friction in some pockets? Are they harmonious? What do you think?
Well, if I've got solid rocket boosters that will be powering SLS being built in my district, I'm probably not going to be real keen on the kind of work that SpaceX is doing with the Raptor, because it's a pretty efficient engine that's putting out a lot of bang for the buck. Whole different kind of engineering, different set of uses, but I'm still going to be really protective of my solid rocket booster manufacturing company. So that's to be expected, and that's normal. None of us like it, but it's there. In terms of other resistance, I thought it was fascinating to watch Elon Musk have to sue the Air Force just to get the right to bid, because the Air Force had that standing placeholder contract with ULA for launches. Now, was that wrong? Well, from the Air Force's perspective, perhaps it wasn't. They wanted to have a standby capability that they knew they could do rapid launch with. And at that point, SpaceX was still kind of new, and you weren't absolutely certain you could make that happen. I don't think that argument's valid anymore, and we're never going to see the old days come back. So, yeah, I think there's still resistance, and I think it's going to be harder and harder to defend. Now, of course, as I think, David, you would be the first to agree, it's a little hard to get change in Congress quickly, but that's why we vote. We try and get people in there with some progressive mindsets that will look at this experiment that we're entering now in terms of private space flight and the entrepreneurs and really wish the best for all of us. And there's a place for the traditional aerospace companies, too. I mean, they have been forced to evolve and adapt, maybe not as quickly as you and I would like, but they are. And I think they're smart people. They know what's going on. I think the hardest thing for them in some cases is the fact that they're answerable to investors, and that forces them to operate in a different way.
If there's a setback with crewed space, either SpaceX or Boeing, those are the only two options, is that going to be a major setback in Congress? I'm not talking about, you know, standing down, trying to find the troubleshooting, you know, the correction, you know, what time it takes to do that. I'm talking about, is this going to cause a revolt reaction in Congress with either more regulations or some kind of hostile or not so friendly regulatory environment that might impede the growth of the commercial human spaceflight industry?
That's a fantastic question. I think, in fact, that's one of the sets of questions I asked you when I interviewed you. We were talking about policy. I mean, it's kind of in its nascent stages now in terms of regulating these newcomers, especially when it comes to civilians. It, you know, beyond what the FAA does for commercial flight, which isn't entirely applicable, how do you rate risk factors for civilians? And then the insurance company get involved, and you've got disclaimers that may or may not hold up in court and so forth. So It's really tough to say, and I think that's an area that's evolving very quickly. Largely, I think, due to the efforts of some of the lobbying by the new space entrepreneurs, and also to the National Space Council that's engaging in that conversation. It could go quicker, but it's going fast enough, I guess. But you know, I have this horrible fear, as I think many of us do, that a SpaceX crewed launch is coming up, and they're doing that cold fueling thing once the guys are already in the rocket.
Right.
And we have a repeat of what happened before. They tell us that can't happen. I hope they're right. They tell us there's an emergency escape system that would work quickly enough to be safe. I believe them. But even if it does, that's pretty scary. I mean, we just faced something not too dissimilar with that Soyuz launch. It won't stop us from going back to them. So maybe, you know, maybe we'll see a little bit more tolerance for risk on our side. But our you know, I spent the day today talking to Apollo astronauts. And when you bring up risk, there's a lot of tongue-clicking and rolling the eyes like, you know, if they knew half the stuff we had been doing that we didn't say in the downlink at the time and on the hot mic, they would have gone bonkers. But and we were much more accepting of risk then than we are now. And you've had Rand Sindberg on the show, right?
Many times, uh-huh.
Yeah, I mean, great book, great conversation. You know, can we get to the point where we can accept a little more risk without inviting disaster? And that's half a chapter.
I might add into Boeing and SpaceX that Virgin is supposed to start their commercial flights, too. So we might add, would something happening with Virgin and space tourists on board cause a congressional regulatory nightmare on the industry?
Yeah, and how different is it when you have an accident that involves the death of a bunch of civilians versus government astronauts heading up to the space station? I suspect in some ways it's probably much worse, and in some ways it's not. It's all bad, but we know things are going to happen. Just as in early aviation, planes crashed all the time, and even really until the turbofan engine got to be terribly reliable, you had problems. A lot of times they could glide into landings because they were going slower, and they had nice large wingspans and so forth. But, you know, when you leave the ground in a big machine with a bunch of liquid explosives in it, you're going into the danger zone. That's kind of what happens.
Where is Space 2.0 available? Is it now in bookstores all over the place, Amazon, Barnes & Noble?
It is not only available in bookstores all over the place, including Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, and your local bookseller, but it is available in print, softback. It is available in Kindle and other e-book platforms. It's available as an audiobook, and it's going to very soon be available in Mandarin Chinese.
Are you the one who read it for audiobook?
Heavens no. We were talking about that. I had approval. They submitted a few reads. I thought, I want to try this. So I read a chapter just to put a sample on my podcast because I thought this will be my Christmas present to people who can stand to listen to me talk for half an hour. And it is so hard to keep, I've got the enthusiasm, but to not stumble over words like I just did right there, and to keep your pacing and your levels consistent and everything, those guys are magicians. So as soon as I finished that, I thought, I'm not even going to send this in because this is way too hard for 300, 350 pages to do this. So God bless them. So the guy that did it was great.
So available in all sorts of different formats. Off of your website, do you get autographed copies?
Actually, what happened was I set up a deal with the publisher. So if you go to their website and buy it directly, they are supplying signed copies from there, which they shine.
So who's the publisher? Ben Bella Books?
It's Ben Bella Books, yeah. B-E-N-B-E-L-L-A, one word.
And they have autographed copies for people who want your signature.
Yeah, basically, as the orders come in, they just tell me how many to sign, and I ship them back, and they ship them out, which is great, because if you're shipping books domestically, you know, media mail, they're $4 or $5 a piece. But as I discovered when I did a giveaway last year for Amazing Stories, if you end up having a winner from Norway, it's $35.
Yeah,
to ship a single book. It's nuts.
Yeah, it's a big difference.
Yeah, so I'm happy to let them do it.
You ought to do your electronic signature like the Major League Baseball teams do with the baseball player autographs on bats and balls and shirts and jerseys. It's an electronic replica of their signature, and therefore they don't have to sign each one.
So electronic as in just printed?
I don't know if it's printed or not, but I wanted to buy a couple of Los Angeles Dodger autographed baseballs with their pitcher, Sandy Koufax, and it says on them, authentic Sandy Koufax autograph electronically reproduced, or something like that.
That sounds almost like the old auto pen days. And here's the thing, you know, if it's my autograph reproduced by electronic means or auto pen, it's only worth 50 cents. If it's my real autograph, it's worth $1.50.
Not on Major League Baseball. The balls are worth like $100 or $50.
Well, yeah, but I'm talking about my signed book.
No, so I didn't buy one. I didn't buy one because I just thought that was a jip. I wanted an original Sandy Koufax autographed baseball for my friend who just goes crazy over Sandy.
And how much are those?
Couldn't find it. I probably could go online or to some collector place, or maybe eBay might have one. Then you'd have to verify that it was really an autograph, an original of his. But I didn't like the electronic signature autograph things. I know that's the way they do with a president, and they send out, you know, copies of the bills and the legislation. Those are all electronically reproduced signatures. So, or at least some of them are. You ought to just sign them all, and then each one of your signatures would be a little bit different, and everyone would know it was an authenticated original signature.
And it's interesting, every now and then I'll kind of be scanning Amazon or occasionally eBay, but usually Amazon, the used book side, and I'll see, you know, signed copy of a book that I know I never signed because, you know, it was sold overseas or I didn't have a chance.
It was so somebody faked it.
Yeah, and they're selling them for $150. So the first thing I want to say is, which I've written a few, they don't write back, of course, is A, I know that's fake, and B, I'm just going to pay that much for one of these books. What's wrong with you? But they figure they'll find some goofy guy who will do it. I think the nice compromise these days, and I've done this and I know other people do too, is that people ask for things. You sign a book plate and you mail them a book plate, and that goes inside the front page. It's not quite the same as having it signed, but it costs 80 cents.
Yeah, it's a lot different. And logistically, it's not as complicated.
Yeah.
Listeners, there's still time if you want to call us, other than Marshall being our only caller tonight, 1-866-687-7223. And for those of you who still want to get in an 11th hour email, we still have a couple of minutes left on our program. So it is drspace@thespaceshow.com.
Can I mention something?
Sure.
I just remember, are you coming to ISDC this year, do you think?
Yes, and here, guess what? I finally heard from the media guy. I sent a note today and saying, fourth inquiry plus inquiries to my friends. Could somebody please reply?
Oh, dear. Well, so I told you, you're covered.
Yeah, but you need to get a badge and you need media representation, all that crap. So anyway, the guy said, you know, we're all volunteers and you're the first one to apply and we haven't even set up the page yet and da-da-da-da-da. It's real early.
Yeah.
But, so anyway, yes, I'm planning to be there. I have my hotel. I have my air flight. I have my boarding kennel for the dog and I shall be there.
Because we have a Space 2.0 panel that we're doing on Friday, and I'll moderate it, so I'll talk to really smart people. And so far, we've got Greg Autry, Lori Garver, I think John Logsdon, and possibly one or two others. So that ought to be a crackerjack morning, and I'll try and sneak a commercial in for the book while I'm there. But I thought, you know, should I do a talk on it or should I? No, because really the book is about talking to these folks and getting their points of view because they're the smart ones, right? They're the ones that are involved in working in the trenches and, in Lori's case, you know, running a big chunk of NASA in her time and so forth. And I wanted their input, and I thought this is a great chance to update it for 2019 and let them discuss and hopefully hash out a few things on stage while we're there. So I'm pretty excited about that. So that'll be Friday the 6th, I think.
Well, I'll support you any way I can, so let me know.
Okay, great.
So if somebody conks out and you want me to be on the panel, I'm happy to do it.
Oh, yeah. I would enjoy that.
Well, so put me on.
All right.
They've all been on. All the people you've mentioned have been Space Show guests.
Oh, sure.
And Greg is coming back April 16th on the
show. Yeah, I was going to say, you just had him on, too, didn't you?
Last year. And he'll be on again April 16th. And I know he's the chair of ISDC this year.
Yeah, and he's sharp.
Now, so you want me to help out with anything or participate on anything, just let me know. But I'm confirmed and already booked into being
right
there. So, and I'm staying at the conference hotel.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Oh, good. That makes
you have another caller. Hang on.
Okay.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you? Where are you? And again, thank you very much for calling.
Yeah, I'm Charles Lurio in the similarly frigid area of Boston.
Well, Dr. Lurio, it's nice to know that you have not frozen into an icicle.
Not quite.
But
are
you colder than Iowa, which is where Rod is?
No, actually not, to be honest. We're not getting down to 5 degrees.
It's 13 now, so we're still relatively balmy.
Are you going to ISDC, Charles? It's not far from you.
Wait a minute. Where is it?
Alexandria, Virginia.
Yeah.
What do you mean that's not far from me? If you live in California, maybe you don't think it's not far, but
you can take a train
enough
and probably 4 hours be there, right? Or
yeah,
3 hours?
Well, anyway, so what was this thing I heard earlier in the show about SpaceX haters or dislikers? Are we just talking about crotchety old space guys, or are we talking about
people
that have a number against them?
No, I know people who I hear from, and a couple of them post on the blog, and they're simply not fans of SpaceX, and they have their reasons why, and they don't think the company's nearly as successful as it should be, and they don't like the public behavior of Musk, and they're very critical, and you know, nobody's got 100% love fair going on out there, including you, Charles, with the Lurio report. So why should SpaceX be any different?
Well, and GM's got haters, you know. I mean, if you had had some of the General Motors products I've owned over my lifetime, you probably wouldn't like them either. But that's engaging on the
Now, I, but, of course, have only a love fest with all my listeners.
That's true.
I have nobody that ever speaks ill of the space show, so just don't listen to Open Lines on Sunday, and you can believe that fantasy. But I live in California, which is the land of everyone's fantasies, so why shouldn't I have fantasies, too?
Well, and you live in a really nice part of California.
Well, since Southern Sonoma County is very, very nice. A lot of flooding going on right now, but and the traffic problems are like the 405. But it is a very, very nice part of California.
Yeah.
I mean, politically, it's the same as the rest of the state, but it is a very nice part, and the people are genuinely friendly. And when I walk the dog, the people are very friendly, and their dogs are very friendly, and everybody cleans up after their animals. I mean, it's really a very nice community area for people. You're 100% right on that.
But I think, you know, it's interesting, getting back to the question, I mean, there are issues, I think, that those of us who have watched us for a long time have with companies like ULA, you know? Do I hate it, ULA? No, I think they're great. They've fulfilled a wonderful role. Their progenitors brought us the ICBMs, and we needed them for national defense, powered the Gemini program and the Mercury program, and have done amazing things since at a price. And where Elon came along with SpaceX and hopefully Blue Origin soon is upsetting that apple cart and saying, as Robert Half, you say, but books cost too much. This could be rockets cost too much, and they don't need to cost that much, and as it turns out, it's true. Now, early on, I think a lot of the people that were grumbling about SpaceX said, yeah, they can't do it, and I think he's shown that he can. Can he continue to do it at this pace? I hope so. Will he build out the Falcon Heavy 20, 30, 50 more times, or will he move to BFR, or will he do something else? I don't know. I would like to see a little bit more spin control out of the company, but that's their decision, not mine.
I remember one time Gwen was, she was either teaching my class for me at the University of North Dakota, or she was a guest on the space show, or she could have said it on both, but this was the early days when Gwen was on the show, and she mentioned that they had recently opened a Washington, D.C. legal office, and, so I asked her why they needed a legal office, and she was talking about, you know, lobbying and competitive things and the regulatory stuff. This is all when Space Act agreements were brand new and, you know, human spaceflight was in a lot of turmoil as what it was going to be like with the private companies. And somehow she mentioned opposition to SpaceX in my naive Oklahoma way, and it was naive back at the time. I said, opposition? Who out there would be opposed to you guys building your own rockets? And she let me know who would be out there, not by name, but was very clear on opposition that they had and resistance that they faced to a lot of their business planning and what they wanted to do, and that they did have kind of enemies, might be a strong word, but really strong parochial
competitor.
Competition. Yeah.
Yeah. No,
well,
and these are people that stood to lose something, though, right, for the most part?
Yeah, but that's exactly it. I mean, it's one thing to say that some establishment rocket company would be, say, you know, these guys don't know what they're doing. But it's another thing if people just have an animus against the company or against Musk for,
well, I've had listeners,
private reasons.
There's one particular listener who hasn't posted on the blog in a while, but he did post regularly on the blog, and he constantly attacked SpaceX and Musk and said that their track record was a lie and they were a failure and the this and the that. And he would go into great detail about all of that with this guy who I also haven't heard of from a long time ago, who used to come in. This is before I had the new blog in the old system, which was on WordPress, from Australia. And they got into contests all the time with opposition to SpaceX. So I do hear from them from time to time. You know, if 100 people love SpaceX, maybe 2 people don't like them. I mean, it's not very many that I hear of, but I do hear up from them from time to time, and I sometimes see their blog post on, depending on what the contents of a specific show are about. So it's not unheard of. They get pushback from most of us because there are also SpaceX fans that, come hell or high water, SpaceX walks on water. And I'm not talking about, you know, being supportive in that sense. I sincerely do believe that Musk and SpaceX have led the way to transforming space, and that he has generally been successful in accomplishing the goals that he has set out. And he has made a hell of a difference, and he has inspired hundreds, if not thousands, of people to be in aerospace and get an education.
Absolutely. He's been the keystone success for the industry, and hopefully he won't have any major
hiccups along
troubles
the way. Yeah, well, we all
in the near future,
that.
At least for a few more years.
But he's in a risky business, and he's a high risk player, and he's got high risk, you know, rockets with a lot of explosives. So you nothing's guaranteed in life, and I think, you know, I'm not a rah-rah sis-kumba SpaceX walks on water guy, but I think there we wouldn't be where we are today without him.
Well, and I think it's also worth mentioning that, you know, there's the engineering expertise, there's the cost reduction, there's the way he runs the company, which is apparently a bit of a stern stepfather, but it works. That may be an exaggeration, but he's careful, let's put it that way. But then you see things like, and a lot of people sort of shrug this off, but when he launched the Falcon Heavy, and he had a choice of launching just plain old boring ballast, as he put it, or his Roadster,
yeah.
He not only did the Roadster, but he put, as you know, this dummy, this mannequin reclining in a spacesuit with his arm lounging over the side of the driver's door. There were people that complained about that.
Oh,
but
yeah.
As far as I'm
don't
concerned,
call them
from a
dummies.
Meteor perspective,
they hate that when you
that was.
That.
They hated that. Yeah, I got
they
lots of mail on that.
They hate that when you do that to them.
they really didn't like it. And they claimed it was going to, you know, even if it had a remote chance of crashing on Mars because of planetary protection, you know, we've all heard that.
No,
unfortunately, Mars wasn't
going to
be anywhere near that position when it crossed Mars, the Martian orbit. But it didn't go quite where he expected it to. But my point was, you know, how many people do you think that moment inspired? When we saw that shot of Starman... First, the fairing comes off perfectly on the musical beat. I mean, this is a guy that's got style. He's got rock and roll mojo.
Showmanship.
And even if you kind of dismiss that stuff, it was transformational to a lot of young people.
Oh,
I had
absolutely.
A lot of communiques from people through the magazine, because I wrote it up, saying, that was just amazing, and I don't know why, but I'm completely inspired now.
Absolutely.
Same thing that we got from Apollo, I think, if we were of that generation.
It was very inspirational to a lot of people. And,
it was incredible.
But there were people that did strongly object to it. And the new planetary defense person, who I'm still trying to get on the show, has revised our planetary defense policy, which I like to talk to her about, as a result of that, to make sure that kind of launch does not happen again.
Because she's concerned that it'll come back and re-enter in an uncontrolled fashion?
And wasn't sterilized and this and that and the other. And
so,
you know, but anyway, if I get her back on the show, people can talk to her about it.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm all for the sterilization argument during the robotic science phase up to a point. So right now we can go to a lot of places, but we can't go near ocean worlds or potential water deposits on Mars. But, you know, when that first... BFR / Starship / whatever it's called when it happens, sets down on Mars, and that first Voyager gets out and sets foot on the soil.
All over.
Potentially
with.
The game's over.
Yeah,
now,
the game's
for
over.
For my money, that soil is so toxic and the UV radiation so nasty, there's very little that's going to survive there. But, yeah, we might wipe out some indigenous microbe that we never saw and won't see. And as you both know, that's a whole different argument, but... We got to do it. We just have to do it.
Well, to my way of thinking, I would rather see Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle protection from what's going on in those cities than planetary protection on Mars, which I think is a bigger threat to human life than anything that's going to happen on Mars. But I'm just one guy, you know, aging in Petaluma. What the hell? Charles, what did you really call for? You didn't just call to BS with us, did you?
No, I really called just about the SpaceX thing, and I just wanted to pull that out, and that's it. It was just an impulse to say a few words about that.
Well,
thank you.
Have you gotten a hold of his book? Have you seen his book, Space 2.0? It's a real keeper.
No.
You should get it.
Well
maybe if you go to Are you going to be at Space Access, Rod? Are you going to be pushing the book there or anything like that?
I don't think I'll be pushing the book, but I'm planning to go.
Good. I'll see you there.
Because I got completely spoiled last week, because I do signings sometimes, you know, and there's always the conversation with the publisher, is it worth it? And you go there on Thursday night, and you've been flogging it for weeks, and 30 or 40 people show up, and it's nice, but it's a day by the time you're done planning and going and lugging the books up and all that, if you do that. I just went to the Tucson Festival of Books, first one of those things I've been to. There was 130,000 people at this event. I did three panels. And, you know, they were with people like Jim Hansen and Alan Stern, so there was a name draw there beyond mine, thank goodness. But they were standing room only, and we got 100, 150 people in some of these rooms. I thought, this is great. So it makes it hard to go back to the 8:30 a.m. Thursday room where you got just enough people to sit and have coffee and donuts, you know. Not saying that Space Access is like that, I'm just saying.
Well, I look forward to seeing you there. And you wanted to know, because I know we're over the time limit, you wanted to know about the Space Museum up in Novato, California.
Yeah, because I did a little more research on it, and I didn't realize they were the ones behind Space Festival, which looks terrific and it excites me because have you been to that, right?
No, I know the people well.
Yeah.
And I've been to some of their events at Barnes & Noble, and I've gotten speakers for the Space Museum in Novato. I have never been there. I've been to some of their events in hotels in the Bay Area, but I'm only 10 minutes there from where they are. But I've never been there, and I've never been to the festival, and I really need to go there. I mean, I really, truly, if there's no traffic, I'm maybe 10 to 12 minutes from the museum.
Do I have to come pick you up on the way? Is that what we're
saying? Well, I live north, so I would have to come probably pick you up. You'd be coming from the south.
I got a nice new car. I enjoy driving. I'll come get you.
A Tesla?
No, it's a Jaguar. I'm not quite hip enough to have a Tesla.
When are you coming up for it?
I think it's in early June this year, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I'll have to go see what it is.
What I like about it is that it's one day, and it's all tents and pop-up covers and stuff, but it's basically taking over a big part of the strip mall, I think, where his shop is.
Yeah, it's Pachinko Parking. It's Pachinko Shopping Mall.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But it's every, you know, it's kids, it's adults, it's...
Oh, everything. It's
like
a big draw. Yeah,
you know?
It's a very big draw.
Yeah, and I like that kind of cross-section of an audience because those are the people that, personally, that I really want to have a conversation with, and others, too. But, you know, I like having the broad conversation where I say, look, folks, this is important. No, NASA doesn't get 25% of the federal budget. No, the ISS didn't crash. Yes, it's important. Yes, there are many benefits for you from space. No, it's not just Tang. And really, you know, smooth over some of those things so we can get a more robust conversation going on a more sophisticated level. But you got to start somewhere, and I think those kinds of functions are great for that, especially when kids come.
So it looks to me like it's August 4th.
August, sorry, yeah. I see.
No, Sunday, August 5th of 2018.
Yes, okay.
So I need to...
That was last year.
Right. So maybe it's August 4th this year. I don't... Yeah, August 4th.
I don't think they have a 2019 date up yet. I couldn't.
No, it does. It says 2019 Novato Space Festival, August 4th, 2019.
Oh, okay.
So 151 days, 12 hours, 46 minutes, 37 seconds. So I need to not do a show on that Sunday so that I can go there.
Well, we'll pre-record one.
Well, we could do that, or I could take my recorder there and record people there.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
You know, and just do roving man on the street interviews with people. I could do that, and then
human on
and
the
then
street,
archive
man.
It in the parking lot. It's in a parking lot. But Charles, you ought to come out for it.
One day.
I wonder if I can get a press pass to this damn thing.
I'll make you one.
This is Space Fest.
It's called the Space Station, the Novato, Novato, Space Festival for the Space Station Museum in Novato, California.
Right.
I'll put a link to it in the write-up of this show. And I'll contact the guys. Maybe I'll see if I can do a show with them. And free admission and free parking. Well, I don't need a press pass. So
there you go. You can go incognito.
That's
a real
fun. No, no. I'm going to wear pepper swag. Are you kidding? I'll wear my pepper swag space show stuff.
You'll see you coming a mile away.
Okay. So here, they don't have a listing of who's going to be there yet for 2019.
Okay. Well, and me.
But I will be there, and you will be there, and maybe Dr. Lurie will drive out to Novato, California, coast to coast.
Boston. Yeah, why not? So what do you drive?
Me? I'm not into cars at all.
No, him. Oh, what does he drive?
He's not into cars either.
I got an old Toyota Corolla.
Ah, it'll make it. Come on. Think of the adventure.
And I got a somewhat recent Camry, but not that recent. I told you I'm not into cars at all. I could care less
about it. Yeah, but it's the most reliable car in the Western world.
All they do is they go their money from me to the car dealer or the car repair shop. So I'm not into cars. And driving is not that much fun in my area because of traffic. You're just sitting in the damn thing, and the traffic is so bad.
Well, but, David, you clearly have a mesmerizing effect on your guests.
But the space museum, I mean, they're not a sponsor, guys, or anything. I'm just telling you, they're not a sponsor. But this is a first-class, really high-quality space museum financed by this one guy. I forget his name, but he has the W Foundation, the letter W. And this is his collection, and he's real interested in it, and it's available to the public to educate people about space. And he has authors there and speakers there, and he has my friend who's on the show all the time about her Exvis 15 book. I got her to come up and speak.
Oh, Michelle?
Yeah, Michelle is coming up in the near future to come speak there. So for those of you, I'd say, depending on traffic, it's maybe 40 minutes north of the Golden Gate Bridge, to give you an idea of where it is. But it is absolutely worth visiting, and if you're going into the wine country, it's on the way, either there or coming back in Novato, Novato, California. And again, they're not a sponsor, so I'm just talking about them out of my heart. And Rod, I've printed it out. I'll put it on my calendar.
Great.
And I will see you there.
Cool. Yeah, I was talking to one of the Apollo guys about it today, who was telling me how great he thought it was, and I thought, well, okay, that's about as good a record.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah. It is really good. And I went to one of them when they had it in, I think it was the Embassy Suites Hotel or something like that in San Rafael. And it was amazing. Lots of astronauts were there, and Hollywood actors were there. It was really fun. And great museum artifacts.
Yeah, and he was featured on, what was the name of that show that just came out? Space Dealers or something?
I don't know, but he's got over 8,000 attendees at the Space Festival.
Yeah, which is an incredible number compared to what most of these things draw.
Uh-huh.
So that's really, that just nails it.
So, I'll see maybe in mid-July or something, I'll see if I can do a space show with him about it.
Excellent.
All right. Charles, anything else for you?
No, I'm just trying to stay awake, to tell you the truth.
Thank you for your call, Charlie.
Thanks.
No, not because of the show.
Good save.
And everyone, Charles has the Lurio Report, so you might want to check it out. It's a subscription newsletter, but it is very, very high quality.
Your show. I love your show, David. You
Thank
know
you.
That.
But check out the Lurio Report, everybody. And Charles, we'll talk to you soon, okay?
Okay.
Thank you. Rod, I know you're over by 20 minutes. So we almost did a full 90-minute show. So any closing comments, any farewell comments you want people to know about your book? The foreword by Buzz Aldrin, what anything remarkable that Buzz said that you want the listeners to know?
He was reflecting on, I think it's obvious, he was reflecting on his time as Apollo astronaut, his expectations of what might have come ahead, some disappointment that hadn't arrived, and, you know, being gratified that we're finally on the cusp of that and how important it is for people to embrace that. He's also got some material deeper in the book about the cycle and so forth, but the foreword was really important, and I wanted him to do it because I wanted besides what he had to say, you know, it's important for the average buyer to look at this and think, okay, I don't know who this Rod Pyle guy is, but I know who Buzz is, so this must matter. That's all I want. You know, just take the book off the shelf, flip through it. If you don't like it, you don't have to buy it. But if you do find it interesting, you know, read it, learn more about this, and by golly, if you liked it at all, please leave a review on Amazon, because it is unbelievable to me how hard it is to get those posted. It's a click on a star, or hopefully five, and, you know, two sentences is all it takes. And I'm guilty of it, too. You know, I'll read a book.
Yeah, I am, too. I should.
3 minutes of my time, it's like, I'll get back to that. Then I don't, and then I realize that I'm doing exactly to those guys what happened to me. So I run back, and I review 10 things at a time. So, yeah, those are important, because that's what makes us able to continue doing these things, just like supporting the space show.
Absolutely. Support everybody. Okay. I will see you at Space Access, at ISDC, and at Novato. And if you can use me for something at ISDC, just let me know.
Great. I'll get Dave Bressler to reach out to you.
Other than, you know, cleaning up after or something, I'm not interested in doing that.
So. Oh, well, now you're getting dicky.
No, I'm talking about using my brain and experience to whatever degree anyone might think it's worthwhile. I can be available while I'm going out there.
Excellent. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being on, and I'll see you soon.
Always a pleasure, and I look forward to talking to you also soon about your Apollo anniversary historic book.
Outstanding.
Thank you, Rod. And listeners, thanks for your call and email. And back on Friday morning for the Friday Space Show program. Good night from Rod, David, and the Space Show. Keep looking up, everybody.